Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Nancy Oriel, Faculty Dean for Community Engagement in Medical Education at the Harvard Medical School and founder of the Family Van, a mobile medical clinic that provides free health screenings for Boston's underserved communities, which she founded in 1992. She'll talk about the power of this upstream health intervention and how it's improving health outcomes, saving money, and saving lives. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Nancy Oriel here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
And we're speaking today with Dr. Nancy Oriel, Faculty Associate Dean for Community Engagement in Medical Education, Lecturer on Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard School of Medicine, and founder of the Family Van, a mobile medical clinic which provides free health screening in Boston's most economically challenged neighborhoods. She earned the Dr. Lewis W. Sullivan Award for contributions to the delivery of quality care to Black men and the Pearl Birnbaum Hurwitz Award for Humanism in Medicine. She earned her bachelor's degree from Boston University and her medical degree from Harvard Medical School. Dr. Oriel, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much for having me here.
You know, and first of all, let me just say we had the opportunity to have you talk with us at the Weizmann conversation. And really, you're somebody that is our hero because you're so ahead of your time in the work that you've been doing. And really, one of the innovations, which I think is the Family Van, which is this mobile health clinic you launched in the early 90s. And sounds simple, but the reality is when you execute at the highest level, it really is a transformational vehicle to help people improve their health and their outcomes. And I'm wondering if you could talk about how that Family Van is addressing health disparities by bringing prevention right to patients.
So bringing prevention right to patients is absolutely what it's about. And thank you very much. I need to say that you're one of my heroes, having heard about the work that you did starting in 1972. So speak about being ahead of your time. So bringing prevention right to people is critically important, but it's so much more than just bringing prevention. It's really about bringing relationships that build trust. It's about helping people get the sense that they can manage their own life, giving them the knowledge they need to take better care of themselves, listening to people, listening to what they want, what they need, listening to how things fit in their lives, and not just sort of plunking down, well, here's some preventive service and just do it.
Well, Dr. Oriel, I think it's safe to say that you were decades ahead of your time on this idea of upstream work. And I think people get that sometimes almost more than prevention, that we're really going up before the problems begin. But now that's something that both insurers and payers and everybody in healthcare has bought into. And I often think of it as this is looking for the silent things, the things that people walk around feeling great while their blood sugar is rising and their blood pressure is rising, while they may be engaging in behaviors that put them at risk for HIV. Of course, it reduces burden on the health system further down the road. Tell us, how have these interventions improved health outcomes? And is there a tie that you've been able to make to reducing health expenditures because of this upstream intervention?
So I think if you get information to people in a way that they can use it so they can manage their own lives, then, you know, that's sort of primary prevention. You help people take better care of themselves. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how many of us actually do that.
Right.
And what most of us do is when something is not seeming right in our lives, we often ask a friend, what do you think about this? And if your friend is a knowledgeable neighbor, if your friend has more information, knows more than you, you will often take their advice. So we are the knowledgeable neighbor for the communities we serve. People come to us, they were something they're concerned about, something they don't understand, and we can sort of help talk it through with them. And sometimes that's all you need. You actually need someone to sort of stand with you and support you as you're trying to make change. When you're trying to improve your life, Nothing is a straight line. Everything is, they're challenges. Mm-hmm. And having someone who knows your challenges, stands with you, witnesses it with you, that makes you be able to take better care of yourself. It empowers you. And all of that then helps avoid the cost of poorly managed chronic disease. And also, there are a lot of times when if you're not quite sure what to do, the answer might be, well, I better go to the emergency room because you've just become very scared. Yeah. But in fact, sometimes you just need to talk it through and you don't actually need to go to the emergency room.
Interesting.
You know, what I really like about this model that you have is that you saw beyond just that it's a mobile clinic in a neighborhood. And you've really started to say, we're not only trying to connect with people, but we're trying to connect neighborhood to neighborhood. So there's this whole mobile clinic movement across the country. But you, along with your Harvard colleague, John Brownstein, who we did have on the show, he talked about Uber Health with us. You know, you really started to say, how do we bring best practices to the willing folks who were running these mobile clinics? And how do you start collecting data? And then how do you start telling the story about the intervention? Walk us through that process of how you started to connect the network and the movement together.
So I'd been executive director of the Family Van for about 10 years, but we were just working very hard to make ends meet and do the work that we were doing in Boston. I was introduced to the Mobile Health Clinics Association. I, you know, went to California to their conference, and I saw this room full of people, all of whom were running mobile clinics, all of whom were having exactly the same problems we were having. They were struggling to make ends meet. It was a group of people sharing best practices with each other. Mm-hmm. But all of us were working so hard that we didn't really have time to think about data. Fast forward, you know, we started thinking about, well, if we had a way of collecting data and sharing our data with each other and analyzing our data, one, we could understand what the mobile clinic sector is all about, because nobody knew who we were or where we were. We were all doing our job in our own little local area. Mobile Health Map was created, where we put tools on the web. Mobile clinics can use the tools. We bring the data together. We sort of create reports so the mobile clinic can know what is their impact, you know, using the research that we've actually worked with. And Dr. Brownstein's mapping program was what really got us started, of being able to localize where the mobile clinics are and then help each one of us prove our value and our outcomes.
Dr. Oriel, let me sort of turn it a little bit. Obviously, the mobile clinics are a very high touch relationship with patients, and that high touch is part of the core of relationships in primary care. But they also are often wrapped within the high-tech resources that we have. I think all of us across the healthcare continuum are looking at how technology can be our friend, something that really amplifies our ability to care for people. And we think particularly about remote monitoring and telehealth. These are strategies that technology makes available to us. What are you thinking about this in the mobile clinic movement, the use of remote monitoring and telehealth, the strategies that might be helpful to your cause as well?
So I completely agree. The view of medicine as just the doctor in the office doesn't quite work. We really need to reach out much more than that. And that, like you say, might be high touch. You reach out, you drive the van out to community, or it might be using telehealth, anything that connects the patient to the healthcare system. It has to be tailored. I mean, that's the whole point of mobile clinics, is that they're designed to fit their community. Well, every community is extremely different. And what the community needs, what the people need, and the resources that are nearby, they might be nearby, they might be far away. In rural areas, absolutely having telehealth will be an amazing solution to many problems. So I think the point is pulling it all together and tailoring it to the needs of the communities and the resources that are available in a way that works for everyone.
We're speaking today with Dr. Nancy Oriel, Faculty Associate Dean for Community Engagement in Medical Education, lecturer on global health and social medicine at Harvard School of Medicine, and founder of the Family Van, a mobile medical clinic which provides free health screening to underserved Boston communities. Dr. Oriel was also director of obstetric anesthesia at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And you've also developed tools that made childbirth easier, including the walking epidural. you've taken your broad knowledge, you've applied some critical thinking to things that you're passionate about. Talk a little bit about the passion that motivates you as a physician, as a human being, and how you have framed up some of these interventions that have become used all around the world.
So the walking epidural, which is, it's such a shame we named it that, because many people say, who wants to walk in labor anyway? But with all of these, it's been about seeing problems from the perspective of the patient. Obstetric anesthesia, the standard of care was, if a person wanted pain relief for childbirth, the choice was to be completely numb and weak. And I didn't know very many women who wanted to be numb and weak during childbirth. So it seemed to me to find a way, a better way, that would give the woman what she wanted, which was the ability to be there, the ability to move, to just feel normal, but to not have labor hurt as much. And I think the point is that it is always about what the patient wants. Some people don't want to feel anything. That's great. If that's what you want, that should be your choice. But many people actually just didn't want to be numb and unable to move. When I first started doing the walking epidural, I would get comments from people saying, why isn't more better? And I would often ask, if you were going to have a stomach ache and I gave you the option of being at home, stuck in your bed, unable to move at all in exchange for making your stomach ache better, would you choose that? And generally, no. Most people don't want to be so numb and so weak. So it's about looking at it from the patient's perspective and figuring out what would I want and then creating that.
Well, Dr. Oriel, I know that you have devoted a good bit of your time at Harvard to the mentoring and the training of the next generation. You're the Associate Dean of Community Engagement and Medical Education. So you're at this incredible intersection of very talented young people. They've made the choice for healthcare or for medicine, and now they're going to make the choice about where they go for specialties. And, you know, certainly primary care is often not the first choice. That we, another one of our former guests, Andrew Morrisinger, was the founder of Primary Care Progress at Harvard. So I'm sure you've run across him over the years. But in the interest of improving prevention as a vital part of the American care system, in the interest of making sure that we recruit the best and the brightest from all the disciplines that can serve as primary care providers to consider that, what's your strategy for inspiring people to think about primary care or the primary care disciplines?
So I was dean of students at Harvard Medical School for 19 years, and Andrew was one of my students.
Well, you did a very good job. You inspired
him. I watched many students go through medicine and make their choices. Now, remember, I'm an obstetric anesthesiologist. I chose that field because it spoke to my heart and my brain. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So students have to pick what suits them. Primary care is an amazing field, and for many students, it's absolutely the right choice. I think primary care as a field has some issues it needs to work with, and it's beginning to sort of alter the relationships to use team-based care. I mean, the sense of trying to be everything to a patient is daunting.
Sure.
But the beauty of having sort of the longitudinal relationship of actually, you know, especially getting to know patients and their families, that's a spectacular way of practicing medicine. One, I do think early exposure to healthcare outside of the walls of the hospital is important to helping students choose primary care. Mm-hmm. But I also think that all of the advances that are happening in primary care, I think that is also what is making it more attractive.
Yeah.
And the students can see their professional lives, their academic lives, you know, and their joy.
Mm-hmm. You know, certainly health policy looms large for whatever field that you're in. And I think right now we are a nation in flux as we're starting to think about the next presidential election that's coming up. We're certainly hearing a lot from Democratic candidates about a variety of changes that they'd make in health policy. I'm wondering how you think our policymakers should be addressing the issues around coverage and access. Certainly the cost of training is enormous, the burden that people carry. Wondering what animates your mind as you think about policy issues.
To be quite honest, I have to start by quoting you. And you said, the goal is to make healthcare a fundamental right available to all. So that motivates me. Yeah. So we in Massachusetts are unbelievably lucky. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, well-organized healthcare. We've got, you know, almost universal coverage. But having insurance isn't the whole answer.
Right.
You know, access is having access to care that you can utilize because it suits you well. Care that makes you feel welcome and helps you lead a healthier life. So healthcare should be available to all. Having health insurance is a critical step. And then building a healthcare system that is welcoming and makes you feel respected and treated well.
Well, that's great. Just from your perch, and you've had so many incredible opportunities to look over the horizon of things that are happening, anything that you're keeping an eye on right now in terms of transformations that are going on that really excite you?
So I was recently at the Gold Summit, and the Gold Humanism Medicine is a movement that's, you know, been very active in medical schools. And at the Gold Summit, they had a leadership track, and there were CEOs from various for-profit organizations that are not the first thing you think about in terms of healthcare. And they are all understanding that it's about going out to the people and actually getting to people. But what was really wonderful was they were there at a humanism and medicine conference. Hmm. Looking at, if you are going to bring healthcare into the work you do, then you need to do it in a humanistic way. So I think healthcare as we know it is going to be expanded. I think the way you access healthcare is going to increase. I think it's just going to be more user-friendly. And I think there are many people are thinking about that and building systems to make that be so.
Yeah, I think about our cities like Boston, like San Francisco, and the increasing pushing out of low-income people into the suburbs so that we can convert the heart of the city into the playground of the affluent, really. With your family van, you must have a front row seat at the incredible transformations underway as the cost of living in Boston skyrockets. And we're hearing from community health centers that they're having to follow patients to the suburbs because the traditional neighborhoods are no longer the epicenters they were of low-income neighborhoods. And what are you seeing from your perch with Advance?
Absolutely the same thing. And I think that's one of the reasons that mobile clinics and other entries into the healthcare system are going to be around more. I think telehealth is going to become more important for that reason. I think mobile clinics have a place in all of healthcare. So we know for a fact that they were using them in Silicon Valley because the, you know, young people working in the different businesses weren't actually getting up to the healthcare system.
Sure.
We were invited to be part of the inauguration of Larry Bacow at Harvard University. And so we parked the van in Harvard Yard, and people who were walking through Harvard Yard came on the van. Mm-hmm. So I think mobile clinics as a way of accessing healthcare probably have a role in places more than just in economically disadvantaged. So I think as we build a more networked and creative healthcare system, I think we're going to have to be reaching people of all socioeconomic statuses where they are in a way they.
We have been speaking today with Dr. Nancy Oriel, Faculty Associate Dean for Community Engagement in Medical Education, lecturer on global health and social medicine at the Harvard School of Medicine. She is also the founder of the Family Van, a mobile medical clinic which provides free health screenings in Boston's most economically challenged neighborhoods. You can learn more about her work by going to familyvan.org and go to mobilehealthmap.org. Dr. Oriel, we want to thank you for your pioneering work in health equity, for improving maternal health and childbirth outcomes, for inspiring generations of healthcare providers and students, and of course, for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
And thank you very much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
A headline circulating on social media misleadingly tells users that Democrats chose to vote down a health record system for veterans while approving the same for immigrants who crossed the border illegally. The bill in question did not affect veterans. The Democratic-controlled House in late September passed a bill largely along party lines that would create new requirements for the Department of Homeland Security to research and recommend ways to improve the medical screening of immigrants who cross the border illegally. And it requires an electronic health record system to be established within 90 days. Since the House passed the bill, it hasn't moved forward in the Republican-controlled Senate. But a headline circulating on a YouTube video from an account called Top Stories Today offers a grossly distorted take on what the bill does. It says, quote, "Dems vote to enhance Medicare for illegals now, vote down vets waiting 10 years for same service. The legislation didn't concern veterans' medical care." The VA currently has an electronic health record system, but in 2018, it awarded a contract to a health IT company for a new system that can link in with the Department of Defense's system. The project is expected to take 10 years to complete. House Republicans, opposed to the Democrats' border legislation, introduced a last-minute amendment to push back the electronic record system's implementation for immigrants until September 2027, and then cited a connection to the in-the-works VA system. Republicans said the amendment would make sure veterans get their electronic record system first. That spawned the now viral misleading headline that Democrats, quote, "vote down vets." And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor at factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Wichita, Kansas nurse practitioner Michael Warzuski learned of the harsh and often fatal conditions that expectant mothers endure in sub-Saharan Africa, all because they live too far from a medical clinic, he thought there had to be a way to fill that need. Believing that every human being should have access to quality health care, he came up with a solution, Clinic in a Can, transforming shipping containers into fully equipped mobile clinics and operating rooms that can be shipped anywhere in the world where there is a need.
When you walk in the inside, you will believe or think that you're inside your doctor's office or inside the clinical environment for which maybe you're an emergency room or an ICU unit. They look exactly the same.
Warzuski learned from his early iterations that gas-powered generators could be problematic in low-resource areas and switched all of his portable clinics to solar power, which he says was a game-changer.
There's no part of the world that does not have sunlight. And so solar power has become the cornerstone of how we re-engineered how we power our clinics so that now every piece of equipment, including the air conditioners, we can run it off of 500 watts of electricity, which means six solar panels on the top and eight batteries is enough to run a clinic for 18 hours.
Since its founding a decade ago, Clinics in a Can have been delivered to war-torn Sudan, to earthquake-ravaged Haiti, and more recently to Santa Rosa, California, an area decimated by the wildfires that also destroyed the main community health center there. Santa Rosa Community Health Center CEO Naomi Fuchs says that the portable clinic provided a lifeline for her patients and was a godsend for her providers.
These are converted shipping containers that arrive fully equipped as a medical exam room. These have been an outstanding way to respond to emergencies and to set something up very quickly.
The roughly 120 square feet shipping container clinics are designed to support workflow and to become a permanent fixture in low resource areas, serving as long-term primary care centers as well.
A containerized clinic is something that's a turnkey. It's all built here in the United States. We equip it with the best equipment, and we ship it as a completed project that once on the ground, within 20, 30 minutes, it's ready to be used.
Clinic in a Can, a professionally outfitted shipping container, fully equipped with medical and surgical equipment, ready for deployment to anywhere in the world where disaster strikes, providing quality state-of-the-art medical facilities in a low-resource area. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.